This is Susan at the Talking Information Center. It is Wednesday, February 18th, 2026. I'm reading for the Diabetes Hour. Type 2 youth diabetes study changes standard of care worldwide. The chief finding, disease progresses faster in youth and adolescents than in adults. This is from the University of Colorado at Denver. A 15-year multicenter study has changed the course of care for youth with type 2 diabetes, enhancing treatments for this growing population and illustrating the scope of the work conducted on the Anschutz Medical Campus. Called Treatment Options for Type 2 Diabetes in Adolescents and Youth, with the acronym of TODAY, the massive clinical trial included 699 participants and was led nationally by Dr. Phil Zeitler, professor of pediatrics and endocrinology at the University of Colorado School of Medicine. The study, which wrapped up at the end of 2022, has already changed the way doctors treat adolescents and young people with type 2 diabetes. The scholarship it has produced is vast. So far, 74 papers have been published, with more currently in preparation. It is the only source of hard data on the treatment of kids as well as the disease course. It is by far the most detailed set of data on kids with type 2 diabetes, Zeitler said. In terms of day-to-day management, monitoring, screening, and recommendations from the American Diabetes Association and the International Society for Pediatric and Adolescent Diabetes, all of it is based on findings from TODAY, Zeitler said. The most recent paper to be published is first authored by Janine Higgins, PhD, co-investigator of TODAY and Director of Operations for the Colorado Clinical and Translational Sciences Institute. The findings, published in Diabetes Care, show that glucose variability, rather than the standard clinical measure of hemoglobin A1c, can more quickly predict loss of glycemic control and development of long-term complications at 10 years. These findings are another step to help manage type 2 diabetes in youth more quickly and effectively. The information in Higgins' publication is just one component in an extensive catalog of information doctors can now use to inform the care they provide to their young patients with type 2 diabetes, which unfortunately continues to increase each year. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention reports that rates of type 2 diabetes are skyrocketing in Black and Hispanic youth. The primary takeaway overall is that type 2 diabetes in adolescents and youth progresses more rapidly than the same disease in adults. As Zeitler is fond of saying, this is not your grandma's diabetes. Though type 2 diabetes in adolescents has a lot of similarities to the disease in adults, it has unique features that demand distinctly different treatment. We need to pay close attention to type 2 diabetes when it is developed as a child. It is not the same course as in an adult. We cannot treat it the same way, Higgins said. The disease progresses more rapidly in the sense that initial therapy does not necessarily last as long, so there is a higher failure rate with therapy, Zeitler said. It becomes more difficult to control. Moreover, treatments that may work in adults often are ineffective in adolescents and youth. In the New England Journal of Medicine published findings from the TODAY study, this paper authors show that youth-onset type 2 diabetes leads to serious complications by early adulthood. The good news is there are now drug treatment options for the disease that did not even exist before. Here in Colorado and across the country, physicians are studying the effectiveness of these treatments in youth with several clinical trials. Higgins explains that once a study closes, the NIH normally does a follow-up study. But, she said with TODAY, so many poor outcomes were discovered so early in life, the NIH is doing something very unusual. We are doing a prequel, Higgins said. We are going back in time to see what precipitates this disease in kids. The study is in the design phase now and will be co-led by Kristen Nadeau, MD, and Megan Kelsey, MD, at Children's Hospital Colorado. and the Clinical Translational Research Center. Zeitler said, "We know there is a very close relationship of disease onset and puberty, so the next study will put together a large cohort of kids who are pre-pubertal to try to understand who gets the disease and what are the predictors, so we may understand how to intervene to prevent it." Emerging breakthroughs in diabetes treatment, a new era of hope from Mount Sinai. As a venture investor in healthcare, I am privileged to witness the remarkable advances being made in the treatment and management of diabetes, a condition that affects over 537 million people globally. The prevalence of type 1 diabetes is expected to increase from 8.4 million to between 15 and 17 million by the year 2040. The urgency to find effective treatments and potential cures has never been greater. Diabetes, whether type 1 or type 2, is characterized by a reduction in functional insulin-producing pancreatic beta cells. This loss is a common thread that links both forms of diabetes, suggesting that strategies aimed at replenishing beta cells hold therapeutic promise. Traditional approaches, such as whole pancreas transplantation and pancreatic islet transplantation, have shown efficacy but are limited by high costs, the scarcity of donor organs, and the invasive nature of the procedures. It's therefore imperative to also develop scalable, cost-effective solutions that can reach the millions affected by this chronic disease. The quest for a simple pill. For over 15 years, researchers at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai have been at the forefront of diabetes research, striving to identify a drug capable of inducing the regeneration of human beta cells. In a significant breakthrough in 2015, they discovered Harmine, a small molecule that is capable of stimulating beta cell replication. Esra Karakos, an assistant professor in the Department of Medicine, is now studying the mechanism of action, and her team's latest publication from an in vitro study suggests that Harmine, I'm unsure of the pronunciation, is inducing fate conversion, where alpha cells, another type of pancreatic cell, transform into beta-like cells capable of producing insulin. This revelation opens new avenues for treatment, as alpha cells are abundant in individuals with diabetes. By harnessing this potential, we may be able to address the underlying issue of beta cell loss in type 1 and type 2 diabetes. Intriguingly, another group of researchers, including Andrew Stewart and Peng Wang, published another recent study in which they gave Harmine alone or in combination with a GLP-1 to mice transplanted with human pancreatic islet cells. Harmine increased the human beta cell mass by 300% with Harmine alone and by 700% in combination with a GLP-1. The question was, how could we see such a dramatic increase in beta cell mass if the proliferation of beta cells was small, Karakos said. Now, with my research, we believe that alpha to beta cell conversion was playing a role. Karakos is currently planning further experiments using advanced single-cell sequencing techniques to better understand the molecular pathways involved in this regeneration process, hoping to confirm her findings in human islet cells transplanted into mice. There are also clinical studies ongoing with Harmine, and new studies are planned. It will certainly be interesting to follow whether the GLP-1s in combination with Harmine truly do show a synergy in future human trials. If so, the dream of a simple, inexpensive pill that could serve as a solution for millions of people may not be so far out of reach. Potentially groundbreaking cell therapy. In parallel, Sana Biotechnology is pioneering a revolutionary approach to islet cell transplantation for type 1 diabetes that circumvents the need for immunosuppression. Their innovative hypoimmune technology enables the transplantation of engineered islet cells without triggering an immune response. This study represents the first instance of a successful donor-derived islet cell transplantation in a fully immune-competent individual without the need for immunosuppressive therapy. Historically, the rejection of transplanted cells has posed a significant challenge in transplant medicine, necessitating lifelong immunosuppression for recipients. SANA's approach, which includes gene modifications to create cells that evade both allogeneic and autoimmune detection, could fundamentally change the landscape of diabetes treatment. The implications of this research are profound, as it may pave the way for one-time treatments that restore insulin production in patients without the complications associated with immunosuppression. Our goal is to make this at a scale that can transform this disease globally, Haar said. For the recently announced study, transplanted cells came from a cadaver, after which they were engineered to evade immune rejection. The next step in the program, says Haar, is to move away from cadaver source cells, which provided a proof of concept, and instead use genetically modified pluripotent stem cells. These could be grown into pancreatic cells suitable for transplant. There's a virtually unlimited supply of stem cells that could be scaled up for such a commercial effort. A cure for type 1 diabetes is now inevitable, Haar says. All the component parts have happened. The only thing patients have to worry about are time, capital, safety, and scale. We really hope SANA gets to push all those forward, but whether we do or not, I'm confident someone will. Speaking of others, on my trip to Bayer's CoLab in Shanghai last year, I met with immunologist and stem cell researcher Hong Qi Deng of Peking University. He and his colleagues had just published an article in Cell about a unique cell therapy approach for diabetes. While most such therapies have used cadaveric cells or cells derived from donors, Professor Deng is the first to demonstrate that it is possible to use the patient's own cells in the treatment of diabetes. In the recently published study, his team chemically reprogrammed a 25-year-old patient's cells into islet cells. Within 2 weeks after the transplant, the patient's required daily dose of insulin began to decrease, and the patient achieved complete insulin independence on day 75. At the one-year follow-up mark, the patient still did not need insulin and had no transplant abnormalities. The role of artificial intelligence. Beyond pharmacological advancements, we are also witnessing a technological revolution in diabetes management through the integration of artificial intelligence, or AI. A new clinical trial at the University of Virginia aims to assess an AI-powered insulin delivery system that utilizes reinforcement learning to improve automated insulin delivery. This system, known as the bolus priming system with reinforcement learning, represents a significant leap forward in diabetes management. Current automated insulin delivery systems require user input to adjust insulin doses, a process fraught with potential errors, particularly for vulnerable populations such as children and young adults. The updated software system seeks to close this loop, automating the dosing process based on glucose history and meal detection. By eliminating the need for user intervention, this technology promises to enhance blood sugar control, particularly during meals and overnight, thereby improving the quality of life for individuals living with diabetes. The new study will compare how well blood sugar levels are maintained in 16 diabetic adults with and without the AI-powered upgrade. If approved, this AI-powered system could be integrated into existing diabetes management systems, providing a seamless upgrade for hundreds of thousands of users. Living with type 1 diabetes is a full-time job, said Hemant Shakhiri, assistant professor of data science at the University of Virginia, who is helping to develop the new AI system. Kids will benefit the most. That's why I get up early in the morning, because the improvement can be so enormous. The convergence of these groundbreaking research efforts and technological innovations marks a pivotal moment in the fight against diabetes. And this is only a glimpse into what may be coming down the pike. In Leap's portfolio, for example, we have invested in Mozart Therapeutics, a clinical stage biotech company testing a specific autoimmune checkpoint inhibitor for the treatment of early stage and slowly progressing autoimmune disease like type 1 diabetes. The vision of a world where diabetes is no longer a life-altering condition is becoming increasingly attainable. I am optimistic that the efforts of researchers, healthcare professionals, and technology innovators are paving the way for a future where diabetes management is more effective, accessible, and ultimately curative. People with severe diabetes are cured in a small trial of a new drug, from the New York Times. Most in a small group of patients receiving a stem cell-based infusion no longer needed insulin, but the drug may not suit those with more manageable type 1 diabetes. A person's conventional supplies for treating type 1 diabetes, a single infusion of a new treatment called Zimislecel, may have cured 10 out of 12 people with the most severe form of the disease. 1 year later, these 10 patients no longer needed insulin. The other two patients needed much lower doses. The experimental treatment, called Zimislecel and made by Vertex Pharmaceuticals of Boston, involves stem cells that scientists prodded to turn into pancreatic islet cells, which regulate blood glucose levels. The new islet cells were infused and reached the liver, where they took up residence. The study was presented at the annual meeting of the American Diabetes Association and published online by the New England Journal of Medicine. It's trailblazing work, said Dr. Mark Anderson, professor and director of the Diabetes Center at the University of California in San Francisco. Being free of insulin is life-changing, added Dr. Anderson, who was not involved in the study. Vertex, like other drug companies, declined to announce the treatment's cost before the Food and Drug Administration approves it. A Vertex spokeswoman said the company had data only on the population it studied, so it could not yet say whether the drug would help others with type 1 diabetes. About 2 million Americans have type 1 diabetes, which is caused when the immune system destroys islet cells. A subset of islet cells, the beta cells, secrete insulin. Without insulin, glucose cannot enter cells. Patients with type 1 diabetes must inject carefully calibrated doses of the hormone to substitute for the insulin their body is missing. Type 1 is different from the more common type 2 diabetes, which usually occurs later in life. Controlling insulin levels is a constant, often costly effort. Elevated blood sugar levels can damage the heart, kidneys, eyes, and nerves. But if levels fall too low, people can feel shaky, pass out, or have seizures. The patients in the study are among the estimated 30% with a complication of type 1 diabetes, hypoglycemic unawareness. Those with the condition have no warning when their glucose levels are falling precipitously. They lack the normal signs, like shakiness or sweating, that can signal a need for glucose. Patients with hypoglycemic unawareness can suddenly pass out or have seizures or even die. It's a frightening way of life, says Dr. Trevor Reichman, director of the Pancreas and Islet Transplant Program at the University Health Network, a hospital in Toronto, and first author of the study. You worry all day, every day, where your glucose is and what you eat and when you exercise, he added. Patients in the study began to need less insulin within a few months of being infused with new islet cells, and most stopped needing the hormone altogether at about 6 months, Dr. Reichman said. He added that patients' episodes of hypoglycemia went away with the first 90 days of treatment. If the study continues to show positive results, the company expects to submit an application to the Food and Drug Administration next year. For the short term, this looks promising for severely affected patients like those in the study, said Dr. Earl B. Hirsch, a diabetes expert at the University of Washington who was not involved in the study. But patients in the trial had to stay on drugs to prevent the immune system from destroying the new cells. Suppressing the immune system, he said, increases the risk of infections and over the long term can increase the risk of cancer. The argument is this immunosuppression is not as dangerous as what we typically use for kidneys, hearts, and lungs, but we won't know that definitely for many years, Dr. Hirsch said. Patients may have to take the immunosuppressant drugs for the rest of their lives, the Vertex spokeswoman said. The treatment is the culmination of work that began more than 25 years ago when a Harvard researcher, Doug Melton, vowed to find a cure for type 1 diabetes. His six-month-old baby boy developed the disease, and then so did his adolescent daughter. His passion was to find a way to help them and other patients. He began, he said, with an unwavering belief that science can solve the most difficult problems. It took 20 years of painstaking, repetitive, frustrating work by Dr. Melton and a team of about 15 people to find the right chemical cocktail to turn stem cells into islet cells. He estimated that Harvard and others spent $50 million on the research. Dr. Peter Butler, a professor of medicine at the University of California, Los Angeles, and a consultant to Vertex, said he was awed by the achievement of the Harvard team. "The fact that it worked at all is just freaking amazing to me," he said. "I can guarantee there were 1,000 negative experiments for every positive one." When Dr. Melton finally succeeded, he needed a company to take up the discovery into the clinic. He joined Vertex, which took up the challenge. The first patient to get the experimental therapy, Brian Shelton, got an infusion in 2021. He had been plagued by episodes of plummeting blood sugar that made him lose consciousness. Once he crashed his motorcycle into a wall, and another time he passed out in a yard while working his mail delivery route. The infusion cured him, but he died shortly afterward from what Vertex described as dementia symptoms that began before his treatment. Recruitment of the 12 patients in the new report proceeded slowly, Dr. Reichman said, because of the strict entry requirements. Some who qualified backed out when they heard they would have to take immunosuppressive drugs, he added. "You might look healthy, but hidden fat could be silently damaging your heart," from McMaster University. A large study led by scientists at McMaster University has found that fats stored deep inside the abdomen and liver can quietly injure arteries, even in people who seem healthy on the outside. The research, published in Communications Medicine, questions the long-standing use of body mass index, or BMI, as a reliable indicator of obesity and heart risk. It offers new evidence that the fat people cannot see may be just as dangerous as the weight they can. Visceral fat, which surrounds internal organs, and hepatic fat, fat stored in the liver, have long been associated with type 2 diabetes, high blood pressure, and heart disease. However, their direct impact on artery health had not been well established until now. Using advanced MRI scans and data from more than 33,000 adults in Canada and the United Kingdom, the researchers discovered that higher levels of visceral and liver fat were closely tied to thickening and clogging of the carotid arteries in the neck. These arteries carry blood to the brain, and when they narrow, they increase the risk of stroke and heart attack. This study shows that even after accounting for traditional cardiovascular risk factors like cholesterol and blood pressure, visceral and liver fat still contribute to artery damage, says Russell D'Souza, co-lead author of the study and associate professor in the Department of Health Research, Methods, Evidence, and Impact at McMaster. "The findings are a wake-up call for clinicians and the public alike," says D'Souza, a faculty member in the School of Global Health at McMaster. "The results should prompt both doctors and patients to pay attention to hidden fat, not just visible weight." He led the research with co-author Marie Pigere, associate professor in McMaster's Department of Medicine. The analysis drew from two major population studies, the Canadian Alliance for Healthy Hearts and Minds and the UK Biobank. MRI scans were used to measure fat distribution and artery condition. The team found that visceral fat was consistently associated with plaque buildup and artery wall thickening, while liver fat had a smaller but still important effect. These relationships remained significant even after adjusting for lifestyle habits and metabolic risk factors such as diet, exercise, and cholesterol. The findings highlight the need for clinicians to look beyond BMI or waist measurements when assessing heart risk. Imaging tests reveal fat stored around internal organs may offer a more accurate picture of cardiovascular health. For people in midlife, the study is a reminder that even a normal weight does not guarantee a healthy heart. Hidden fat can quietly increase the risk of serious disease without obvious physical signs. You cannot always tell by looking at someone whether they have visceral or liver fat, says Sonia Anand, corresponding author of the study and a vascular medicine specialist at Hamilton Health Sciences in the Department of Medicine at McMaster. This kind of fat is metabolically active and dangerous. It's linked to inflammation and artery damage, even in people who aren't visibly overweight. That's why it's so important to rethink how we assess obesity and cardiovascular risk. The following articles are from the Diabetes Self-Management Periodical. Low Blood Sugar and Vision by Diane Fennell. Diabetic retinopathy is a serious complication of both type 1 and type 2 diabetes. It affects the blood vessels in the retina and can lead to permanent vision loss if left untreated. While high blood glucose has long been associated with this condition, new research suggests that low blood sugar or hypoglycemia, especially in people with fluctuating glucose levels, may also play a harmful role. In a new NIH-funded study, scientists at the Wilmer Eye Institute at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore found that hypoglycemia may cause the blood-retinal barrier to break down. This barrier regulates the flow of nutrients, waste, and water into and out of the retina. When it's compromised, vision damage can follow. The researchers induced hypoglycemia in mice with and without diabetes. Mice with diabetes had much higher levels of a protein called hypoxia-inducible factor, or HIF, which has been linked to eye diseases. HIF triggered the production of other proteins that caused blood vessels in the retina to leak, key contributors to diabetic retinopathy. Interestingly, this did not happen in the mice without diabetes. When the researchers gave a separate group of mice with diabetes an experimental drug called 32-134D, which blocks HIF, before inducing the hypoglycemia, they saw something remarkable. These mice did not show signs of blood retinal barrier breakdown or blood vessel leakage. This raises the possibility that the drug may help protect vision by targeting HIF during episodes of low blood sugar. These studies help explain why patients with diabetes who are initially started on tight glucose control or those who have high glycemic variability experience worsening of their diabetic eye disease, said senior author Akrit Sodhi, MD, PhD of the Wilmer Eye Institute. Less TV, Healthier Heart by Diane Fennell. We all know that too much screen time isn't great for our health. Now, a new study published in the Journal of the American Heart Association finds that watching less television might have an especially protective effect for people with a high genetic risk for type 2 diabetes. The research, based on data from more than 346,000 adults in the United Kingdom, found that people who watched TV for 2 or more hours per day had a 12% greater risk of developing atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease than those who watched for 1 hour or less, regardless of their genetic predisposition to type 2 diabetes. The researchers analyzed health records, lifestyle information, and genetic data from participants in the UK Biobank, a large long-term health study. The average age of participants was 56. 45% were men, and none had a history of cardiovascular disease or type 2 diabetes at the start of the study. Each person was given a genetic risk score for type 2 diabetes based on 138 gene markers. They also reported how much TV they watched each day, either 1 hour or less or 2 hours or more. The study had several limitations, including that TV time was self-reported, which may lead to underestimates. over nearly 14 years of follow-up, 21,265 people developed heart-related conditions like heart attack, stroke, or peripheral arterial disease. Just over 20% of participants watched 1 hour or less of TV per day, while nearly 80% watched 2 or more hours. Those watching 2 or more hours had a 12% higher risk of atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, regardless of their genetic risk for type 2 diabetes. Among people with a high genetic risk, limiting TV viewing to 1 hour or less was linked to a lower 10-year risk score than even those with low genetic risk who watched a greater amount of TV. This suggests that less TV viewing could serve as a key behavioral target for preventing atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease linked to type 2 diabetes genetics, said study co-author Mengyao Wang, PhD of the University of Hong Kong. This study is one of the first to examine how a sedentary behavior like TV viewing interacts with genetic risk for type 2 diabetes in relation to heart disease. The results suggest that even among people with inherited risk factors, lifestyle habits such as limiting screen time can have a meaningful impact on health. These findings add to the evidence that sitting time may represent a potential intervention tool to improve health in people in general, and specifically for people with a high risk for type 2 diabetes, noted Damon Swift of the University of Virginia, who was not involved in the research. Make your insulin work smarter. How movement supports your body, no matter your size, by Catherine Alvarez. When most people hear the word exercise, they think of sweat, soreness, and maybe a little guilt. It's often tied to dieting and weight loss. But here's the truth. Movement offers so much more than a smaller number on the scale. One of its most powerful benefits, better insulin sensitivity. What is insulin sensitivity? Think of insulin as a key that unlocks your cells so glucose or sugar can enter and be used for energy. When you're insulin sensitive, that key fits smoothly. But when you're insulin resistant, the lock is jammed and your body needs more insulin to get the job done. The great news, physical activity can improve how your body responds to insulin, whether you have type 1 or type 2 diabetes. And if you don't need hours in the gym to see these benefits. Types of movement that help. Different types of activity support insulin sensitivity in unique ways, and combining them can maximize results. Aerobic exercise, like walking, swimming, or cycling, can increase insulin sensitivity for up to 48 hours. Even a brisk 10-minute walk after dinner can make a real difference in post-meal glucose levels. Resistance training, using weights, bands, or body weight, boosts your muscles' ability to take in and store glucose. It also builds strength, supports bone health, and makes daily tasks easier. Interval training, alternating bursts of effort with recovery, improves glucose uptake and insulin action, a great option when you're short on time. Flexibility and balance work, like yoga or tai chi, doesn't directly impact insulin sensitivity, but supports mobility, reduces injury risk, and helps you stay active long term. Getting started, tips for beginners and for older adults. You don't need a gym or fancy gear to get moving. If it's been a while, small steps are a great place to start. Walk after meals, even around your home. Use a chair or wall for support during balance exercises. Try seated strength moves with resistant bands or soup cans. Set a timer to stand or stretch every hour. And be sure to check in with your healthcare team before starting, especially if you take insulin or other medications that lower blood sugar. 3 quick workouts to boost insulin sensitivity. Looking for easy ways to get started? These short workouts can help improve your body's insulin response, no gym required. Number 1, post-meal power walk. Take a brisk walk for 10 to 15 minutes after lunch or dinner to help reduce post-meal glucose spikes. Number 2, resistance band circuit. Using a resistance band, perform seated rows, leg extensions, biceps curls, and shoulder presses. Do 2 sets of 10 to 12 reps each. Number 3, a mini interval walk. Alternate 1 minute of brisk walking with 30 seconds at your regular pace for a total of 10 minutes. The bottom line, forget chasing weight loss. Exercise is medicine. Physical activity helps insulin work more effectively, no matter your size or fitness level. Whether you stretch, lift, walk, dance in your kitchen, every bit of movement helps your body respond better to insulin and supports your long-term health. Catherine Alvarez is a certified diabetes care and education specialist. You're not alone. How peer support empowers those living with diabetes by Karen Graffio and Shelby Kinnaird. Elizabeth had recently been diagnosed with latent autoimmune diabetes in adults, LADA, when she decided to attend a Diabetes Sisters peer support group meeting. The topic that day was diabetes and exercise, and she had several questions about how to properly dose her insulin during workouts. I hadn't worked out at all since my diagnosis because I didn't know what to do, she shared. As others in the group spoke about their own lived experiences, Elizabeth began to piece together some insights. One person noted that their blood glucose tends to rise briefly after resistance training, but drops following aerobic exercise. The more the group shared, the more Elizabeth realized that she actually did know what to do, but something deeper was holding her back. The real issue wasn't a lack of knowledge, it was fear. I was afraid to exercise, she admitted. My blood glucose might go low. My CGM might go off. I might be embarrassed during an exercise class. Everyone in the room immediately understood. They had all felt those fears, too. By the end of the meeting, Elizabeth felt not only more informed, but also less alone, and finally ready to tackle exercising with diabetes. This is the heart of peer support. Connecting with others who understand. You get together and talk with people who just get it. Peer support, powerful and proven. Peer support offers confidential guidance and encouragement for people living with chronic conditions. It can empower you to take better care of your health, improve your quality of life, and better understand your condition. In fact, peer support is an evidence-based approach shown to improve diabetes self-management and outcomes. A widely cited international review published in Health Affairs found that peer support interventions significantly improved blood glucose management, self-care behaviors, and emotional well-being. These benefits were consistent across populations and settings, especially when support was culturally relevant and integrated into routine care. In the diabetes community, people come together regularly to share experiences, challenges, coping strategies, and, just as importantly, their wins. Some groups meet in person locally. Others gather online through platforms like Zoom, welcoming participants from across the globe. Peer support groups can be organized around different types of diabetes. Some focus on type 1, others on type 2 or gestational diabetes. Groups like those hosted by Diabetes Sisters are open to any woman over 18 living with any type of diabetes. Meetings often revolve around a single topic, such as healthy eating, exercise, diabetes technology, or emotional well-being, giving attendees space to learn and connect. General support group meetings, such as those offered by hospitals or local health departments, may include a healthcare provider, like a diabetes care and education specialist. Peer support groups, by contrast, typically do not involve medical professionals. At Diabetes Sisters, peer support meetings, participants are encouraged to share personal experiences, but reminded not to offer medical advice. Beyond the doctor's office, the power of shared wisdom. While your healthcare team is essential for medical guidance, having a peer support network can be just as important in other ways. Peer connections provide real-world, lived experience, the kind of practical, day-to-day advice that only someone walking the same path can offer. It is always a good idea to be around other people dealing with the daily experiences of diabetes. They get what others have no clue about, says Anne. My endo is a man who does not live with diabetes. He is a wonderful doctor who gives me fantastic medical care and guidance, but he can't tell me where to put my insulin pump when I'm when I'm wearing a dress without pockets. He's never had to solve that problem, but many of the women in my support group have. Peer support can also help you feel empowered and more confident in managing your condition. Through our community of women, says Mary, I've learned about different treatment options and gained the courage to try new things. My overall health has improved with the information and support I've received from my group. Stories from the community. Organizations that provide peer support offer a variety of programs to deliver diabetes education and build a sense of connection. One example is Diabetes Sisters, which offers monthly meetups, webinars, and workshops designed to inform, support, and empower. Meetups are confidential, peer-led gatherings held on Zoom. These video-based meetings allow all participants to see and interact with each other and are exclusively for women living with diabetes. Webinars are open to anyone and feature presentations by medical professionals. These sessions are hosted in a Zoom webinar format, meaning only the host and speakers are visible, but attendees can submit questions for live responses. Workshops combine elements of both formats. They begin with a structured presentation and then shift into a more interactive group discussion. Participants find value and encouragement in all three formats. The meetups are a positive mix of needed information and peer support. Both are necessary for successful diabetes management. The great information from a professional in your webinar makes a difference. I enjoy learning more about taking good care of my health. This workshop was so informative, we were able to ask questions of experts and peers and have follow-up discussions. Thank you for such a great program. How to find and join a peer support group. How can you find a diabetes peer support group? Ask your primary care physician, endocrinologist, or diabetes specialist. Search online for diabetes peer support group using a search engine or AI assistant. Talk to others you know who live with diabetes. Check with local hospitals or your county or state department of health. How should you prepare for your first meeting? Be ready to share your diabetes story in a safe, supportive space. Think about questions you have or challenges you're facing. Treat your meeting as self-care. Block out the time and limit distractions so you can be fully present. Finding hope in connection. When Elizabeth attended her first peer support meeting, she realized it wasn't just a lack of information that had been holding her back from exercising. It was fear. Hearing others talk about similar experiences helped her feel less alone and more prepared to take action. She walked away with practical coping strategies, renewed confidence, and the reassurance that she wasn't in this alone. At her next meeting, she shared that she had returned to the gym and even met another woman there who also lives with diabetes. Elizabeth told her about the group and invited her to join, paying forward the support she'd received. Peer support can help you too by connecting you with people who understand what you're going through, offering encouragement, ideas, and hope every step of the way. Next is from the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Big gains in type 1 diabetes glucose control management in recent years. A new study led by researchers at the Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health found big increases in the use of CGM, or continuous glucose monitoring, and insulin delivery devices by children and adults with type 1 diabetes over a 15-year period, with corresponding jumps in optimal blood sugar control. For their study, the researchers used a large national database of de-identified electronic health records to analyze nearly 200,000 individuals with type 1 diabetes from 2009 to 2023. The research team tracked individuals' adoption of CGM and insulin pump devices as well as blood tests. From 2009 to 2023, the proportion of individuals under 18 with optimal glucose control rates rose from 7% to 19%, while the proportion of adults with optimal control rose from 21% to 28%. The researchers used a standard blood test for the percentage of hemoglobin bound by glucose, known as hemoglobin A1C, to measure glucose control. A test result below 7% is recommended to prevent long-term complications. From the first period to the last period, the proportion of type 1 diabetes patients using CGM rose from 4% to 82% among youths under age 18, a more than 20-fold increase, and from 5% to 57% among adults, more than a 10-fold increase. The proportion of patients using insulin pumps during these periods rose from 16% to 50% among youths and 11% to 29% among adults. The concurrent use of both devices also increased dramatically during this period. The study was published online in JAMA Open Network. Improving glucose control in patients with type 1 diabetes has been challenging, so these big increases are exciting for the field, says study first author Michael Fang, PhD, an assistant professor in the Bloomberg School's Department of Epidemiology. These improvements have likely been driven by the widespread adoption of new monitoring and delivery technologies. About 2 million Americans, including 304,000 children and adolescents, have been diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, according to the American Diabetes Association. The once fatal autoimmune disorder typically strikes in childhood when immune cells triggered by a viral infection mistakenly attack and wipe out insulin-producing cells in the pancreas. Insulin, discovered and introduced in the 1920s, was a game changer for individuals with type 1 diabetes. The standard treatment involved insulin injections after meals. This kept patients alive, but glucose control was not always stable or reliable. In recent decades, continuous blood glucose monitoring devices and insulin pumps have allowed patients to optimize glucose levels throughout the day. The sample used for the analysis totaled 186,000 individuals with type 1 diabetes. The findings varied by race and insurance type, with non-Hispanic white patients and those with commercial health insurance having higher rates of technology adoption and glucose control. Among those under 18, 21% of non-Hispanic white patients had glucose control versus 17% of Hispanic and 12% of non-Hispanic black patients. The researchers say that policies that make it easier for type 1 diabetes to access devices such as CGM could help reduce these disparities. While we should be celebrating the improvements, we must remember that most patients with type 1 diabetes don't have optimal glucose control, and there is a lot of room for improvement, says study senior author Jung Shin, MD, PhD, in the Bloomberg School's Department of Epidemiology. The team plans to use the same vast health record database for further studies of type 1 diabetes and trends in common complications such as cardiovascular and kidney disease. AI-powered diabetes prevention program shows similar benefits to those led by people from Johns Hopkins. Researchers from Hopkins Medicine and the Bloomberg School of Public Health report that an AI-powered lifestyle intervention app for pre-diabetes reduced the risk of diabetes similar to traditional human-led programs in adults. Funded by the NIH and published in JAMA, the study is believed to be the first Phase 3 randomized control clinical trial to demonstrate that an AI-powered diabetes prevention program helps patients meet risk reduction benchmarks established by the CDC at rates comparable to those in human-led programs. An estimated 97.6 million adults in the United States have pre-diabetes, a condition in which blood sugar levels are above normal but below the threshold for type 2 diabetes, putting them at increased risk of developing type 2 diabetes within the next 5 years. Previous research has shown that adults with pre-diabetes who complete a human-led program, which helps participants make lifestyle changes to diet and exercise, are 58% less likely to develop type 2, However, access barriers such as scheduling conflicts and availability have limited the reach of these human-led programs. Of the approximately 100 CDC-recognized programs available, AI programs represent only a minor subset, and data demonstrating their effectiveness compared with human-led programs is lacking. In the study, the researchers tested whether a fully AI-driven program could provide adults with prediabetes similar health benefits as a year-long group-based program led by human coaches. Even beyond diabetes prevention research, there have been very few randomized trials that directly compare AI-based interventions to traditional human standards of care, says Dr. Nestoris Mathidakis, co-medical director of the Hopkins Diabetes Prevention Program and study principal investigator. During the COVID-19 pandemic, 368 middle-aged participants with a median age of 58 years volunteered to be referred to either one of four remote 12-month human-led programs or a reinforcement learning algorithm app that delivered personalized push notifications guiding weight management behaviors, physical activity, and nutrition. Overall, participants were 71% female, 61% white, 27% black, and 6% Hispanic. All participants met race-specific overweight or obese body mass index cutoffs and had a diagnosis of prediabetes prior to starting the study. In both groups, a wrist activity monitor was used to track participant physical activity for 7 consecutive days each month during the 12-month study. While participating, study volunteers continued to receive medical care from their primary care providers, but could not participate in other structured diabetes programs or use medications that would affect glucose levels or body weight, such as metformin or GLP-1s. Once referred, the researchers did not promote engagement in the program and only followed up with both groups at the 6 and 12-month marks. The greatest barrier to program completion is often initiation, hindered by logistical challenges like scheduling. So in addition to clinical outcomes, we were interested in learning whether participants were more likely to start the digital program after referral, says study co-author Benjamin Lalani, currently a medical student at Harvard Medical School and research associate working in the Mathidakis lab. After 12 months, the study team found 31.7% of the AI participants and 31.9% of the human-led participants met the CDC-defined composite benchmark for diabetes risk reduction, at least a 5% weight loss, plus 150 minutes of physical activity per week, or an absolute A1C reduction of at least 0.2%. Results demonstrated that similar outcomes can be achieved by a human coach-based program and an AI program. Moreover, the AI group had higher rates of program initiation and completion in comparison to the traditional programs. Researchers believe ease of access increased participant engagement in the AI group, showing that AI interventions could be an effective alternative to existing human-coached programs. As such, primary care providers may consider AI-led programs for patients in need of a lifestyle change program, especially those with considerable logistical constraints. Unlike human coach programs, AI programs can be fully automated and always available, extending their reach and making them resistant to factors that may limit access to human programs, like staffing shortages, says Leilani. So while the black box nature of AI is a commonly cited barrier to clinical adoption, our study shows the AI program can provide reliable, personalized interventions. Looking ahead, the study team is interested in exploring how the AI app outcomes they observed translate to broader, underserved, real-world patient populations who may not have the time or the resources to engage in traditional lifestyle intervention programs. Additionally, several secondary analyses are underway, which intend to explore patient preference with AI versus human, the impact of engagement on outcomes in each intervention and costs associated with the AI programs. As part of a study, SweTech Health and the participating programs received financial compensation for providing services to participants. The programs did not have access to the overall cohort results, did not analyze data from the study, and did not provide interpretations of the results. Martha and the Hopkins University receive royalty distributions related to an online diabetes prevention program not discussed in the publication. The arrangement terms have been reviewed and approved by the Hopkins University in accordance with its conflict of interest policies. From the Diabetes Self-Management Periodical. Fast Track by Gary Shiner. This is a question and answer. Question. I'm flying for the first time next week since getting an insulin pump. Any suggestions on the best way to get through security without risking damage to the pump or the continuous glucose monitor? You have very little to worry about. While manufacturers often warn against taking pumps and CGMs through x-ray machines and full-body scanners, there's no evidence that airport security equipment causes damage. These devices have passed through airport checkpoints millions of times without incident, and I'm not aware of a single case where one was harmed. That said, you may experience a brief delay, especially with full-body scanners. These scanners detect anything not part of your body, so you'll need to explain to TSA agents that you're wearing medical devices. Most of the time, they'll simply swab your hands to check for explosive residue and then let you pass. The process usually takes just a few seconds. If you're directed through a standard metal detector, there's a chance your pump, but not your sensor, will set it off. This is more likely with tubed pumps, especially if you're wearing a metal clip. To reduce the chance of triggering it, you can slip your pump into a pocket and place the clip in your carry-on before walking through. And if the detector is triggered, don't worry, it's the same quick hand swab, and then you're on your way. Question. Is there a way to get insulin to work faster? I get frustrated waiting for this so-called rapid-acting insulin to bring my high blood sugar readings back down to normal. Answer. Putting rapid-acting in quotes is totally fair. There's not much about it that's truly rapid. Traditional rapid-acting insulins, such as Lispro, take about 5 to 15 minutes to kick in, peak around 1 to 3 hours, and stick around for 3 to 5 hours. Even the newer ultra-rapid options are only slightly faster, typically starting and peaking about 5 to 15 minutes earlier than traditional versions. But you do have ways to speed things up. Rapid-acting insulin tends to work faster if you inject or infuse into the abdomen or upper arm rather than the leg or the buttocks. Warm or rub the site after injection. Exercise the nearby muscles soon after injecting. Stay well hydrated and don't smoke. Another option, injecting into muscle instead of fat. It can make insulin act about twice as fast, but it requires a longer pen or syringe needle, and it can be pretty uncomfortable. If you're looking for truly fast action, you might want to try Afrezza, the inhaled insulin, because it's absorbed through the lungs rather than through fat under the skin. It works much more quickly. Afrezza enters the bloodstream in under a minute and begins lowering blood glucose in about 12 minutes, peaks in 35 to 45 minutes, and is out of your system in about 90 minutes to 3 hours, depending on the dose. For more information, visit Afrezza.com.